From Autosport.com and Auto Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Well, welcome to the latest episode of our series looking at the best seasons in Formula 1 history, partly to celebrate 70 years of the World Championship for drivers, but also 75 years of Autosport, so it kind of worked nicely. And how it works is we get a special guest for each episode to pick out their favourite F1 season and then explain why, and then we have a bit of a chat about the main storylines. So today's special guest is someone who you'll know, you'll be more familiar with as our sports car guru, but actually he's had a fascinating interest in Formula 1 for, well, many decades. Should we say that?
Well, from since before you were born, Kev.
There you go, you see. So he's in a strong place to have a view on this. So welcome, Gary Watkins. How are you doing?
Not too bad, not too bad. And looking forward to talking about my favourite F1 season.
These are good fun, yeah. It's always nice to talk about stuff that you enjoy and you like, isn't it? So it should be a bit of a no-brainer. Really, hope people enjoy listening to it as well. So, okay, well, let's get straight into it then. Which season have you gone for and why?
Well, my favourite season of Formula 1 is 1983, so a long, long time ago, but I remember it very well, and I am going to start off by declaring myself as a Nelson Piquet fan, and of course Nelson with Brabham won the F1 Drivers Championship that year, but that is not why it's my favourite season, or perhaps it's a tinsy-winsy little contributing factor. You know, what's not to like about 1983? Three drivers go into the championship finale in with a chance of winning. Eight different drivers score race victories. A different team wins the constructors to the drivers. Of course,
it's always fun when that happens,
well,
isn't
absolutely. It? Absolutely. Yeah. And Ferrari won, well, actually retained, of course, the constructors' title.
Having not won the drivers' championship the year before either.
Indeed, yes. So, you know, there's lots. Those are some of the reasons. I think it's a watershed season because it's the first championship won by a turbo car, for at least for a driver. You know, Ferrari had won with the constructors with a turbo the previous year. And so that was the start of an era. Obviously, the end of the era, last victory for the Cosworth DFV, or DFY as it had become, but, you know, same thing. But there's much, much more to what makes it such a great season for me. And one of them is that all the cars look so different. Just think about it. The Brabham, the BT52, the sort of the Arrow. Then you've got more conventional looking cars, perhaps the McLaren. You know, when I say conventional, it didn't look so different from the previous year's McLaren. And then you have sort of cars like the Acela, which is a sort of a bit of a weird looking thing. And then ugly ducklings like Tolman's TG183B, which is a real, real weird looking thing. And there's yet more. I got to see contemporary F1 cars race on our shores in Britain three times that year. So either side of the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, we had the Race of Champions.
The last one, wasn't it?
The last ever non-championship F1 race. You know, the last of a line, because, of course, going back in the day, Formula 1 non-championship races were, you know, they happened by the dozen if you go back to the 50s. Obviously, they waned over the time. And, you know, even in Britain, it used to be the Race of Champions at Brands, the international trophy at Silverstone, and they both happened every year. But then they started alternating. Then after 79 at Brands, it stopped. But then it was revived for 83. And then come the end of the season, there I was, me, just a whippersnapper of a lad based down the road. I was back at Brands watching proper F1 cars for another championship race, because Brands stepped in when the New York Grand Prix, which is going to take place at Flushing Meadow, was cancelled. I mean, cancelled makes it suggest that it was actually ever going to happen, because it was one that sort of ping-ponged, I can't say that.
Easy for you to say.
Yes, on and off the F1 calendar for a few years. And then that year, it seemed to have a firm slot, didn't happen. John Webb, the boss of Brands Hatch, stepped in at short notice and organised the European Grand Prix at the end of the year. So it's two races to go. No, sorry, the penultimate race. So there I was as a 16-year-old. I got to see proper F1 cars three times that year. Admittedly, the Race of Champions wasn't a great grid, but still, I still got to see the BT52, but with Hector Rabac driving rather than Nelson Piquet. So there's a historical anomaly. But, you know, going back to me being 16 is another crucial reason of why 1983 is my favourite season. And as a 16-year-old, I was studying... I suppose studying doesn't sound... It didn't seem like studying. For my O-levels, and for the younger listeners among you, O-levels is what old farts like me did before GCSEs were invented. So there I was, meant to be revising for my O-levels, and I was looking for any distraction from sort of having my head in, or my nose in my exercise books, swatting up on, I don't know, King Henry VIII and waddies or whatever. So that's one of the reasons. So probably if you're listening, Nelson Piquet, you cost me a grade or two in my O-levels.
I'm not sure he's going to apologise for that, to be honest. I mean, this is a great example of why I'm very pleased that this was going to be I'll do another top 10 and go through all the years myself. But this has been much more interesting because people have come up with some quite big curveballs. 1983 would not have been in my top 20, probably,
really?
To consider.
Oh, wow.
But actually, the more I looked at it, there are a lot of interesting storylines.
And we're going to go on to them, aren't we?
We are going to go on to them. Yeah, well, yeah, no, you've done that, Gary. That's it. Yeah. So, I mean, just to back up what you're saying as well, with the eight different winners, six different teams winning as well. And
there could have been more. We might touch on if we've got time later.
Yeah. And some star drives, which we'll also come to. But I guess before we sort of get into the detail, we should say that, you know, set the scene, you know, there were quite major rule changes. And quite late in the day, it was the end of the first ground effect era.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is probably the catalyst for me sitting here today talking about 1983. At the start of November...
82.
It was announced that ground effect was being banned. Of course, you don't ban ground effect, but essentially... ground effect Venturi tunnels were banned and a flat bottom was mandated between the centre lines of the front and the rear axles. So it's a simplistic way of saying ground effect was banned, but of course there's still effect under the car, whatever's happening. And I always like to quote Frank Durney on this, saying Colin Chapman and Peter Wright didn't invent ground effect, they just learnt how to harness it. So on November the 3rd, I think it was, Jean-Marie Balest, the sort of autocratic boss of FISA, then the sporting arm of the FIA, mandates this rule change. So you're thinking about it. Normally, the F1 season started at the end of January at Kyalami with the South African Grand Prix. And at the beginning of November, they're making a major fundamental rule change, which just sort of in today's circumstances where everyone has to sit around the table for seemingly years arguing about rules, where I always think that it's actually the teams writing the rules these days. Balest turned around and says, no, I'm going to do what I want. We're going to do this. And the only concession to the teams who were faced with having to build new machinery or at least adapt their existing machinery, and we're going to talk about who did what and who didn't in a minute, was that they chucked the South African Grand Prix to the back of the season, and therefore we started in March at Rio. So it gave them another handful of days, basically. Which, you know, is it just seems unbelievable, doesn't it? And it's talking about, you know, Balest doing what he wanted to and felt was right. It's interesting that, you know, we're in the context of the sort of final throes of the FISA FOCA war that sort of was sort of half ended by the first Concorde Agreement in 1981, but sort of lingered on, didn't it, really, into 82.
Teams boycotting Imola and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. And it's interesting, Gordon Murray, who had designed his 1983 ground effect Challenger, the BT-51, not only had he designed it, but he was testing it, was being told by Burnley, oh, no, Balest won't get his way. No way. Of course he did. So Murray had to tear up his design, and more than tear up his design, he didn't, because Burnley would have ordered it, but they actually crushed the BT-51 chassis that they had built, which again sounds amazing.
It's awful.
Took them down. Well, I don't know how they crushed them. You know, they took them down the breaker's yard and got a few quid for the aluminium. I don't know. But yeah, and that it's just like, and then so if you look at all the cars, you can see that some cars, like the Brabham, you know, is a sort of completely different car to the previous years, the BT-49 and the BT-50, the 49 being the Cosworth engine car and the 50 being the BMW turbo engine car, but also the 51, which was very much in their image. It was clearly in a sort of derivation line from those cars. And then you look at, say, the Ferrari, for example, that they started the season with, the 126 C2B. It was a sort of cut and shut of the previous year's car, the absolutely beautiful Harvey Postlethwaite C2, that they turned into a sort of bits of special and made it into one of the most ugly Ferrari racing cars ever.
But it was quite effective, wasn't it?
Well, it
whereas
was.
Some of the previous year, I mean, Renault really quickly realised that the flat bottom version of the RE30 wasn't going to cut it, but the Ferrari was actually pretty competitive for most of the year.
It was.
And then, of course, they brought in the C3. Which was also
not a good look, better looking car, but not a classic.
But I mean, they were both effective in the sense that Ferrari were right in it. I mean, they split their points between Patrick Tombay and René Arnoux, didn't they?
Yeah, hence why they won the Constructors.
Hence why they were Constructors champions, yeah. But they started quite well. So for a while, Ferrari were...
Yeah.
They were kind of favourites. So, I mean, if there was a favourite,
can we just
swung around.
Can we just talk about some of the cars? Because I haven't mentioned some of my favourite cars.
Are they going to be the terrible ones at the back?
Well, like, we mentioned the Tolman, which was a bit of an ugly duckling.
I mean, that is not a pretty car.
But then what about the ATS D6? Gustav Brunner, who designed some beautiful Formula One cars, didn't he? He designed the ATS D6, not a car that... many people will remember, or most people won't remember, because it sort of it didn't achieve any real concrete results, did it? But it had sort of flashes of qualifying form, but an absolute beauty. And then I'm going to say the Osella FA1E, there are actually two cars of that name with an Alfa Romeo V12 engine. The second one, the proper one, which was designed by Tony Southgate, of course, a British design legend, came on stream at Silverstone, and that is just such a beautiful car as well. And if you look at the cars, you've got like the arrow shaped cars, like the Brabham. Think of the Tyrrell 012 that came along a bit later in the season. Yeah, that's right. And the Osella, then you've got cars with long side pods like the Renault and the McLaren, and then you've got a car, the Ligier, and it had no side pods at all. And it's just like, isn't it great that all these racing cars look different? Do you not think F1 would benefit if the cars look different?
Yeah, but that's because we all know better now. We've had this conversation before. It's like, it's everything, you know, the whale has ended up looking like the shark, even though it came via a land mammal.
Right.
So, there you go. We'll get Mark Williams or another engineer in to talk about that. But obviously it's great when you've got different engines as well.
Well, absolutely.
As well as the cars.
That's why I'm so happy that we have the Aston Martin Valkyrie in my world in WEC, because it sounds so different. You know, until the arrival of that car, we only had one normally aspirated engine, the Caddy V8, which obviously sounds great, but not as good as the Valkyrie. And then, you know, a lot of farty turbos are just sort of, woo, you know.
Well, let's talk about one of those turbos. So let's go back to the Ferrari. So they started the season well. I guess maybe Arnoux, bit of a slow start. Well, affected his challenge.
He'd come in from Renault, hadn't he? And he made some mistakes. And I'm told that he struggled making the move from the Michelins, which Renault were on, to the Goodyears that Ferrari were on. And of course, I'm going to say something else that use a term that our younger listeners might not recognize. But of course, the Michelins on the Renault and on the Brabham that year were radial tyres, whereas Goodyears were still cross plies. So, you know, old fashioned tyres is a sort of an old fashioned layup in the way they were manufactured. And apparently he did take some time adapting to that.
It's quite funny, though, isn't it? Because he would have raced on cross plies earlier in his career.
Well, that is a good point. And so maybe that is contemporary writers sort of clutching at straws there. But, you know, I would say that Arnoux was a sort of seat of your pants driver who probably wasn't a guy who would, you know, really work out what was going on. If the car didn't really work, perhaps he wasn't quite there.
It was interesting, actually, for all these episodes, I looked up the Autocourse top 10 drivers, mm-hmm. and although Arnoux did finish ahead of Tombay in the championship, it was Tombay that was put third in the rankings, partly because of his, I think, extra effort, his good start, his consistency. And, of course, he lost some potentially good results through no fault of his own.
Yes, that's right.
Which sort of took... Otherwise, he wasn't far away from being in championship contention either.
He had two poles mid-season at Hockenheim and Österreichring and went out with engine failure both times. Now, give him 18 points. Do the math, Kev.
He had 40. 18 points would have given him 58. So 1 point behind Piquet, well, 1 point ahead of Prost. Obviously, that's not manoevering the other people around as to how many points they scored.
Yes, yeah. Well, so actually, probably they would have lost some points.
He could have, so Nelson would have dropped a place. So they'd have been tied on points then.
Well, there you go. So that just sort of...
could have been that shows it.
And
it was
also interesting that when the C3 came in for Silverstone, that apparently there were some sort of major tactical flaws that they were experimenting with big wing, small wing, and apparently Mauro Forghieri, of course, the longtime technical boss of Ferrari, said no, we got to go with the small wing, you know. Silverstone, fast circuit, got to be fast on the straights, which for me, if I look at Silverstone and go, we've got some very, very fast corners, I'd go for the downforce. But anyway, he said he knew best, apparently against what the stopwatch was saying and possibly against what the drivers were saying. And in the race, it screwed their Goodyear tyres. So again, that was sort of points squandered.
Well, if we're talking about squandering points, I'm just going to get straight in there and say, right, so let's tell us about why Alain Prost, who should have been world champion that year, didn't win it. Most wins for... and actually, a great fact here, his pole position at the French Grand Prix is the second biggest margin in terms of percentage of lap time in the history of the World Championship, only beaten by Nigel Mansell's 92 British Grand Prix lap in the Williams Renault FW14B. Yeah.
Was he over 2 seconds clear?
Yeah, incredible. Eddie Cheever wasn't very happy with his teammate, obviously.
Oh, really?
He was very happy with his own car and balance at that point, but he was still second. But it was 2.3 seconds or something. It was absolutely ridiculous. So, I mean, at one point during the season, Prost is picking up the points, getting the wins. When the RE40 comes in, it kind of puts him right in the game, doesn't it?
Interestingly, the RE40, it wasn't like it arrived and they brought it on stream. It'd been testing for much of the winter, but just sort of they took a bit of a conservative attitude and decided not to take it to the first race, and then made a late decision to take it to the second race. And apparently, did they have only one at the... one at the second race.
Sorry, one at the second
race. So when
they went
to Long Beach, only Prost got it. Which, you know, but apparently, you know, I think it, you know, sometimes you, big teams, corporate teams, manufacturer teams, you know, it's sort of slow decision making. But apparently, that again, that was potentially some points squandered for them. Now, why did, you know, mid-season, it looked like, you know, Renault Prost was on his way to the championship. He was
finally having pioneered the technology and not yet actually won a championship off the back of it.
Well, Renault. Yeah, yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. But that didn't give them a God-given right.
No, to, well, as they showed.
But apparently Prost was obsessed with winning the championship, and he had made comments, you know, this year it's about driving consistency and it's about scoring points, not winning races. But even so, as you say, he was the, as the Americans would say, the winningest driver in the championship that year. Now, where did it go wrong? Well, obviously there was the his mistake at Zandvoort, which was a sort of, in the end, didn't really matter because he took Piquet off.
I was going to say, that was picked out a lot, but not really that relevant.
It wasn't relevant because they both lost points. And, you know, Google it at and have a look on YouTube because Prost basically has a lunge. Well, it's not even a, I wouldn't even say it's a lunge. It's a funny one because
he just starts to drop it under braking. Yeah. It's clearly not deliberate. It's just the back steps out and then he just straightens it into the side of the Brabham.
But you think, you actually look at it and you think, oh, that's a good move. And then it's sort of almost at the last moment. Yeah, as you say,
the back. Just loses rear grip, doesn't he?
So, and then obviously Piquet gets punted off into the gravel. That's the end of him. Prost makes it a few more corners when the wing breaks or flips. I think you can actually see it sort of flips up. So he loses downforce, crashes. So nil point for either of them. So you could say it's not significant, but obviously he was back. It looked like he was quicker than Piquet at that point. So let's say he had beaten Piquet. And outscored him by 3 points, you know. So
then
that,
you've done the job.
Yeah. I mean, as it happens, that was round 12 or 15. Uh-huh. He still comes out of that 8 points ahead of Arnoux, who's second in the championship, and 14 ahead of Piquet. Yeah. So still a lot of work to do for Piquet and Brabham to overtake Prost, but they did it. Now, you've done a lot of work on
why this happened.
So for the final three races of the season, a Brabham leads every lap. So that's Monza, Brands Hatch, the European Grand Prix, and then Kyle Army. So Piquet wins at Monza and Brands Hatch. Then he plays the percentages and scores enough points to win the championship at Kyle Army.
Oh,
and Patrese wins the race.
It doesn't even just give away the win, though. It gives away second place as well. It's like, come on, man.
It's not actually a very heroic way.
It's not very Fever, is it?
No. But anyway, that does take away a little bit of the aura of the season for me. But, you know, so Brabham, or BMW, who produced, you know, that four-cylinder inline turbo engine for the Brabham, had a detonation problem. So they could only go up to certain power and then the engine would start detonating. And it was pretty clear to everyone that it was Ferrari that had the power advantage over the first half of the season. And everyone was talking about water injection used by Ferrari. And Renault were definitely using it as well. Now, BMW experimented with this sort of by adding water to the fuel mix and basically came up with a conclusion that water doesn't burn. So quite
a sophisticated experiment.
So quite, Paul Roscher actually once told me that story with a sort of wry smile, actually. Paul Roscher, of course, was the architect of BMW's F1 program. He was their engine guru and, an amazing character. So they were looking for alternatives, and they'd heard, or Roscher had heard, about some kind of design of fuel that was used during World War II, a synthetic fuel, used in fighter and aviation fuel, you know, which inevitably led to the term Nazi rocket fuel.
It's original.
But, you know, I think it was a design of fuel. So, yeah. And basically, it had a bigger percentage of slow burn hydrocarbons as opposed to quick burn hydrocarbons. And that allowed them to avoid the detonation and run bigger power figures. And they had this in their pocket for some of the season. And they decided that they wouldn't sort of show their hand or use it until later in the season, because, you know, secrets don't stay secret for very long in the F1 paddock. They don't stay, and they didn't then. So they actually introduced it at Hockenheim, which was a race where the car actually went up, Piquet's car went up in flames, actually, wasn't it? It basically, I think that was significant in turning the championship in their favour. You know, just witness their end of season domination. And also, let's just talk about Zandvoort. Piquet put it on pole for the one and only time of the year. Now, whether he would have beaten Prost in that race or Prost would have beaten him, we never got to find out. But it just shows you that there was a sort of a shift in the balance within the sort of that top three pack of Brabham, Ferrari and Renault.
And just to look at some of those stats, actually, so Alain Prost did win four races to Nelson Piquet's three, but actually if you look at laps led, Piquet led 327 to Prost 121, so almost three times as many. Renault Arnoux actually slots in between them, which is
quite interesting, isn't it?
So, well, I mean, perhaps now is the time to have our usual quick chat about the top drivers before we go on to some of the highlights, in the sense
I've just got to tell everyone that I've got the Autosport F1 review at home. It's too big to bring it in because it's sort of bound into a quarter of a year of Autosports. But there is no top 10. And I know Kev has talked about the Autosport top 10 and contrasted it with the Autocourse top 10 in other editions of this podcast. But there isn't an Autosport
one. Just didn't bother. It's too hard.
But normally, you know, and I don't know why isn't it. The nearest we get is Nigel Roebuck, of course, the long-time doyen of Formula One reporting on Autosport. He says something like, Alain Prost was unlucky not to win the F1 driver's title, but Nelson Piquet was not lucky to win it.
Okay.
Which could be the ultimate sitting on the fence, couldn't
but
it?
But worded in a very robot, nice way.
Yeah. And he's right, isn't he, what he says there?
So we won't go through the whole top 10, partly because we'll get to some of these drivers later on anyway, but the top five in Autocourse was at fifth, Keke Rosberg, fourth, René Arnoux, three, Patrick Tombaugh, as we said, they sort them round. Second was Alain Prost, and first they did give it to champion Nelson Piquet. So this might be a stupid question, given that you've already said that you're a Piquet fan. Is that right? Is that fair, do we think? Do we think Piquet was the best driver of 83?
I can't decide. Maybe that's why they didn't do the list.
That's a good point. Like, you know, here we are talking about him having a car advantage at the end of the year. So can I then sit here and say, oh, yeah, Nelson Piquet was undoubtedly the best driver of the year? You know,
a lot of people have felt that Renault, because Prost was saying we need to keep pushing with the development, and there seemed to be a bit of complacency, I think he's always felt, that slipped in to those last few. I think they even rocked up at the last round with like world champion T-shirts or caps or something, and obviously didn't. And then he was the scapegoat. And you have to say, what happened to the rest of the 1980s went better for Prost than it did for Renault.
Well, you say he was a scapegoat, but even during the middle of the year, he was being linked to moves away from Renault. I was flicking through a bound volume of Autosports this morning, and you know, he was being linked very squarely with Ferrari, interestingly.
Amazing.
Now, obviously, he ended up going back to McLaren. Of course, you know, he probably, towards the end of the season, he saw the potential of that new engine that they had, the TAG Turbo. And so probably that sort of took him in that direction. But in the middle of the year, you know, Alain Prost could probably pick and choose where he was going to go. And you would say Ferrari looked like the best option.
Well, one imagines that he would have responded to Ron Dennis's overtures better than Ferrari at the time as well. You can imagine in meetings, can't you?
Well,
Ron
yes.
Ron was probably quite a good person for Prost to speak to at that stage. I'm completely, that was complete conjecture on my part there. But while we're on the McLaren subject, obviously this, so most of the year they are with the DFV before they run the TAG Porsche engine towards the end. Niki Lauda made that happen, didn't he, even though John the barn. I didn't want to do it. But there is a highlight. We're getting into some of the great drives of the season.
I'm going to have to say that we haven't continued the Nazi rocket fuel story.
Oh, you want to continue? Okay.
Yeah. And apparently, you know, if you read Autosport at the time, it's sort of mentioned, but I think in today's era, that story would have been mega news. Yeah. You know, it would have been seized on, you know, it would have been a national press kind of story, not just a sort of specialist press story. And, you know, Prost has always said that he wanted Renault to protest the fuel. And apparently they didn't, because their fuel supplier, Elf, was against it. And it almost, I think Elf didn't, the argument I've heard is that Elf didn't want to be seen to be protesting, because it almost sort of undermined their position if you know that someone else was cleverer than them. Or, yeah, so Prost was pushing. Renault didn't protest, but the FIA, or rather FISA, had the fuel tested by a body called the Institut François du Pétrole. François du Pétrole. I haven't probably said that very well, but I did get a C. Going back to my O-levels, I did get a C in French.
There,
yeah. I did get a C.
Because of Nelson Piquet.
Yeah. So I would have said that right had someone else won the World Championship that year. And they tested it, and it actually came out above the legal limit of 102 octane. But it was 102 point something, not a lot. And the FIA asked, is that within the tolerance of the test? And apparently, Gabriele Cadringer, who for a long time was sort of head of the technical department at FISA and was involved with the governing body for, you know, more than 20 years, told me that he thinks that the FIA or FISA misinterpreted what the French Institute told them. So that test probably suggests that the fuel was illegal. But of course, you know, there would have been A samples, B samples. Brabham would have been able to do their own tests on the fuel, or nominate their own group to do the testing. So we can't say that it was illegal, but we're saying on the basis of that test, potentially it was. And Kenneringer says that he has reservations about FISA's interpretation.
You see, you're edging me towards maybe thinking that Prost should have been number one in the driver. I think I've read somewhere that the Renault had a very rudimentary blown diffuser that year as well.
Yes, I've seen the drawings actually. Yeah, we're in Grand Prix International.
So all that Sebastian Vettel tires were blown diffusers. It happened 30 odd years before.
Isn't that another thing that we're talking about these, you know, the championship protagonists, but the great drives, and if we're sort of chucking them in to top 10s, top 50s, these two drives that we're going to talk about will be in there. But I don't think there's any drive by any of the championship protagonists that we would sort of...
Nothing immediately comes to mind, does it, really?
If you look at Piquet's victories, they were sort of serene, weren't they, rather than dramatic.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I wonder, we'll have to put that test to other seasons and see if we can find some other examples. But so, which one's your favourite then? We've got two to really talk about, I think, haven't we?
I've always been a bit of a John Watson fan ever since I saw him win the 1981 Silverstone Grand Prix, first time I went to Silverstone.
One of the greatest F1 overtakers, I would argue.
Yeah, absolutely. And he proved it, didn't he, at Long Beach, coming from 22nd on the grid to win the race, you know, which counts as a record to this day, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's not looking like getting beaten anytime soon, either, is it? Until Cadillac rock up, then it could happen, couldn't it?
But it is amazing that a record like that has... I know it's a mighty achievement, but, you know, records tend to get broken. I know that the old adage, isn't it, is that they're there to be broken, but this one is one you'd think a set of circumstances would arise.
But isn't this that set of circumstances? Because the car wasn't bad it wasn't a driver car combination that should have been qualifying on row 11.
No,
it was all
no.
about the tyres and not being able to get energy into the
tyre
effectively
yeah.
designed for a turbo, which then on race day means they could drive flat out.
Absolutely.
And let's face it, Watty wasn't as conservative as Niki Lauda when it came to overtaking. They were both coming through together, of course,
yes.
in 22nd, 23rd. But Watson was the one that tended to prize open the doors more often.
That's
probably
right,
fair
yes.
to say.
Yeah, and that's perhaps a good point. This was the set of circumstances that made it happen. Yeah.
So we'll have to see I can imagine a grid penalty, Max Verstappen, Red Bull at the back, 22 cars. I can imagine him doing that, somewhere like Spa.
Yeah, it's some rain or something that shakes the race up. But I also love Rosberg's victory in the Cosworth engined Williams at Monaco. I love it partly because there's some brilliant shots of him, aren't there, sort of oversteering in that sort of nimble Cosworth powered Williams, sort of oversteering on slicks on a damp track. Now he decided to start on the damp track on the slicks. I think it was everyone else. I'm not sure there were.
Didn't his teammate, did Lafitte do it? I think he came. He was running second at one point, wasn't he?
Okay.
A long way further back.
Anyway, the majority of the field started on wets. And who disappeared into the distance on a damp track but the guy on slicks? I mean, I think that is one of the great wet weather drives. And I think you mentioned that you put it in
I think it was in one of my top 10 wet weather drives. I think it was 9th or 10th.
So when everyone had to change tyres as the track dried, obviously he won by, but you know,
he had a problem towards the end as well.
He was having
to carry the car. So
I think those, you know,
two brilliant drives,
and they are the standout drives of that year. Forget about Piquet,
but probably not a coincidence that they're DFV cars. So the McLaren is at the back because it can't put heat in the rubber and comes through as a good race car. And I suspect if you're on a turbo those days turbo lag would have been enormous.
Yes,
and it's a bit damp at Monaco. You think, probably going to be a bit conservative start on wets, whereas with a DFV you might be a bit more, especially if you've got the sort of skills that Rosberg would have backed himself.
Wouldn't he? You know, a guy with natural car control.
Yeah. Quite interesting, actually, the difference between him and Nico, because I'd say Nico Rosberg was almost the opposite to that. Really good on the data, intelligent guy, but as soon as you had to improvise, he tended to struggle
that seemed to be his
strength.
Yeah, but I think actually the Cosworth thing is significant in Rosberg's victory, less so in Watty's. It's the tyres not working. Okay, turbo tyres not working on a Cosworth.
Yeah.
It's an indirect thing. Yeah, not working in qualifying because they can't get the energy into them. But then obviously in the race, they come into their own because, you know, they keep their grip deep into the race.
Now, you supplied some notes. We shared a few notes before this, and there was a line in there that intrigued me because it was something that I had missed, so I'm going to ask you a bit more about it. So you've got how Ligier should have won a race.
Well, sorry, John Watson, but Jean-Pierre Jarier, who was a great talent, you know, a naturally talented driver who just, you know, there was bad luck, you know. Shadows breaking in 1975.
Oh, I think he was third or fourth on my top 10 list of Grand Prix driver not to win a World Championship
right.
race.
Yeah. But he was also a guy who had a bit of an attitude problem. I think he was a bit belligerent. But, you know, in terms of sheer natural talent, he was excellent. Now, he was in a Cosworth car. Now, I'm actually sort of arguing against myself here. He was in the Cosworth Ligier. He qualified 10th on Michelin's at Long Beach and was moving up the order at Long Beach and was a long way ahead of Rosberg when he collided. Sorry, he was a long way ahead of Watson when he collided with Rosberg, having already had a bit of a brush with Alboreto in the Tyrrell, I'm told. So he, you know, there's a very strong argument that he could have won that race because he had the Cosworth engined car on the Michelins that went, you know, that lasted, you know, deep into the race, you know, retained their grip, were highly consistent on that car. But yet he'd qualified, halfway, you know, only on the fifth row rather than the 11th row.
But that's the thing, though, isn't it? What, he was able to pass all those cars cleanly, yeah, precisely, and so, but yeah, no, interesting that Ligier could have won that race. That was one that I had missed. So let's look at a few, to finish off with some of the sort of other watershed moments you've mentioned here. Honda. We've got to talk about Honda. I mean, actually, we're talking about the start of McLaren Tag and the start of Williams Honda.
Well, absolutely. Two combinations that sort of trip off the tongue because of everything they've won. Well, that rhymes, doesn't it?
So, and you didn't write that down.
No, I didn't write that down. No, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Honda come back with Spirit, the team they'd been with in Formula 2 the previous season. And they actually, going back to the Race of the Champions and that non-championship race at Brands Hatch early in the year, that was the F1 return of Honda with a modified F2 car driven by Stefan Johansson. And then they decided to do the second half of the year. So they were back with a sort of slightly less F2-based car at Silverstone that still looked like an F2 car to me, and did the remainder of the season. But unfortunately for them, Frank Williams came knocking. And by the end of the season, we had the Williams Honda, you know.
And it took a little while for that combination gel, but it didn't take very long for the McLaren Tag combination to gel, partly because Niki Lauda was insistent, as we said just now, making sure that car ran in the last two or three rounds.
Yes, and so it started at Zandvoort when it was just one.
And at Kyle Army, he actually came stonking through the field and got high up before he had problems, I think.
It's funny, actually, because Barnard was insistent that, you know, it was all about concentrating on the following year. And apparently he was livid that he had to do some kind of interim car to get it out before.
I think Lauda went to someone at Marlborough to make it.
Yes, I've written this story somewhere.
Yeah,
it's one of the big bosses in Lausanne in Switzerland, and basically got him to pull rank on Barnard.
Yeah. Which paid off, although it was almost scuppered by Prost arriving at McLaren. We came within half a point of... I was just a 1984 podcast. Someone else will pick that as their favourite season. Well, I guess we should just finish off with Lotus as well, who were sort of not going through a great period, sort of only in the first full season, well, first season after the death of Colin Chapman. Yes. So they were in a... Disarray is probably a bit strong, but they...
It wasn't looking good for them. Yeah. I mean, although we shouldn't forget, of course, that Elio De Angelis had won the 82 Austrian Grand Prix, which was their first win since winning the championship with Andretti in 78. I'm right in saying that.
Yeah, that would be their first win.
But even so, they had a disastrous start to the 93 season they had one Renault turbo powered car, one Cosworth powered car, and they were both pig ugly, weren't they? They were sort of these sided thing, and they had the sort of, they're experimenting with active suspension before abandoning it.
So scary that it put Mansell off active suspension, even when he went back to Williams, he went to Williams later.
Exactly. But, you know, so they sort of had a bit of a reset when they brought in Gérard Ducarouge to be sort of technical director, lead designer, after he'd been fired by Alfa Romeo. And we hadn't even talked about Alfa Romeo, and they had a lovely car, the T183. Wasn't that a lovely...
And Andrea De Cesaris would have won
could have
added to the wins list.
So they brought Ducarouge in, and in double quick time, they built that car that raced for the first time at Silverstone, which was a beautiful car. And I think Ducarouge was one of the key pieces to the Team Lotus revival, its final spell as a top line team. And obviously one of the other crucial pieces, the arrival for 85 of Ayrton Senna,
who of course was having his British F3 duel with Martin Brundle during this season.
Yeah.
Actually, to back up your point, Lotus were eighth in the championship in 1983. So Ferrari, Renault, Brabham, Williams, McLaren, and then Alfa in sixth.
Yeah, right, there you go.
Yeah, and that was without the lost win.
That's, yeah.
That's Spa. Well, I think that's probably... Are there any more... you're great for some random cars further back. Anything else that you wanted to pick out before...
I've always had a soft spot for the Tyrrell 012 that arrived that year. And, of course, it was in Benetton colours. So that was the arrival of Benetton, actually, wasn't it, that year,
a good point,
as a sponsor?
Yeah.
You know, and, of course, they then switched to Alfa Romeo and obviously ended up... buying Tolman, becoming Benetton, you know, on and on and on. So that's the sort of the start of Benetton.
Indeed. Well, I mean, that's...
Perhaps the start of Team Enstone. Of course, they weren't based in Enstone then, but, you know, which obviously carries us all the way forward to
Alpine today. But then, of course, that... can trace its roots back to Tolman, so
that's actually true. You're right there, yeah.
Which is why I haven't done a Renault Alpine Enstone list, because I just found it too confusing.
Oh,
I should need to establish my criteria, don't I?
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that's a good argument there for why 1983 is on the list of greatest F1 seasons. Do you agree? Have you got a year to suggest that we haven't talked about yet? If you send us on allsport@allsport.com. And let us know what year you think's best. And maybe if we get enough votes for the same year or two, we could do some bonus ones at the end and just have a chat about some other years, which, I mean, they're all fun to talk about one way or another, really, aren't they?
Yeah.
Apart from 1994, I'm up for talking about pretty much any
really,
one season.
Right, yeah.
Well, thank you very much to Gary Watkins.
Thank you for inviting me.
That was good fun, and I hope the listeners enjoyed it. We'll be back soon with another All Sport podcast.